From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's partisan politics. Before the presidential campaign even started, we witnessed gridlock on Capitol Hill that at one point quite literally shut down the government. During this presidential election season, we've watched month after month of political surprises, levels of division that pundits declare unprecedented, books are written on the battle of ideologies, and willingness to compromise is positioned as weakness. One well-known NPR political commentator compared the heightened vitriol to pre-Civil War era dialogue. But today, we're going to explore how these divisions play out locally and at the state level, and whether this is actually a new phenomenon, or whether the drama is replayed each election cycle and we're plagued by a historical forgetfulness. Joining us today to talk about the divisions, the issues, and party strategies are the two local party leaders. Michael Franklin is chairman of New Hanover County's Republican Party. Michael Franklin, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Poole is chairman of New Hanover County's Democratic Party. Richard Poole, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rachel. I'm glad to be here.
And here to help us with the academic view is assistant professor of political science in the Public and International Affairs Department at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Dr. Aaron King, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to this.
And most importantly, we want to hear from you. What do you think? Are politics nastier today than ever? Why? And whose fault is it? You can email us at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are now open. Aaron King, you teach a class called Culture War with a question mark. Political polarization in the United States. How would you characterize the culture war in the U.S.?
Well, this is a big debate among scholars about whether this culture war actually exists. And it does depend on sort of what aspect you look at. In terms of polarization in government, in Congress, very polarized. In terms of polarized in government in Raleigh, for example, very polarized. But in terms of the public, the average person in the public is probably not that polarized. The average person doesn't think about politics all that much. Of course, we all know some of the more ideological and activist people, and those people, I mean, then we can have a debate about. But it's not that it certainly is happening. It's more about a debate about sort of where the source is and who's responsible.
You're saying that the politicians themselves have become more polarized, but the American public has not.
On average, the American public has not. That's not to say that there aren't polarized people within the public. But certainly in terms of polarization in government, we see more of that than we see with the average voter.
Why has the government become more polarized?
Well, I think that if all the listeners were to think about the most political activist person they know, and maybe it's themselves, if they were to think about that, they would realize that no one's standing from the rooftops yelling, "I'm a moderate, please listen to me." the most activist people that are involved in the process are oftentimes on the ideological wings. And so while sometimes we get upset for politicians to listen to those people, it also becomes easy to understand why they do that when those are the only voices that are out there.
So then what is the culture war? Would you call them ideologues?
Sure. I think people that are more ideological that don't really have any interest in compromising. And of course, all of us have our own beliefs and we think that we're right. And as soon as we think that we're right, we're unwilling to compromise. And so one of the difficult things that whether it's at the party level, even in the county or politicians have is everyone's trying to get something done. Everyone's trying to do something, and ideologues on either side not willing to compromise is not too conducive to that.
I want to talk to the party leaders now. What do you see as different in this election cycle? And what have you specifically had to grapple with that's new this year? Michael Franklin of the Republican Party.
One thing I see is definitely, and I feel, I guess I can, I don't want to speak for you, Richard, but both parties are having trouble rallying around their candidate. You still have the forever Trumpers and the never Trumpers, and then you have the Bernie Sanders people and the Hillary Clinton people. And typically, by this point, we've consolidated around a candidate. Everybody gets it. You don't have to like everything, but that's your candidate, and you're willing to put that forward. And I think what's going to be difficult now is seeing how that translates for your down ballot tickets. you're going to have a lot of people that are not a fan of the presidential candidate for their side. And are they still going to come out and vote for your down ballot races, or are they going to stay at home altogether and protest without a vote? So I think it's going to be very interesting to see over the next several weeks.
Richard Poole, what's been different for you this cycle?
Well, the last two presidential elections, we've had a candidate, Barack Obama, that was articulate, really eloquent, really inspirational. I think Hillary is fond of saying she's a workhorse, not a show horse. And she comes with a track record that people can use to attack her, in our view, often unfairly and without foundation. But that's a big difference.
In terms of you're talking about someone who's a natural politician versus someone who struggles with the charisma part of the equation.
Right. I think that Hillary Clinton's strength will be governing. Her strength is not campaigning.
We have an email from George who writes, there's a raft of strange occurrences this election has produced. I cast my first vote in 1968. What I find remarkable is that Secretary Clinton is held to a higher standard than her opponent on just about everything, where Donald Trump can basically say anything he wants. It is truly a double standard. Michael Franklin.
I don't know how to answer that. I think...
Do you think Donald Trump is let off the hook? I mean, we all know that—
I think the media doesn't know what to do with Donald Trump because they've never had a candidate speak as openly and freely. And I don't know that he gets off the hook. It's they don't know how to call him to the carpet for what he says. And Hillary Clinton is very aware of what she says and how the media is going to portray it. And she's been around so long, they kind of know what her next answer would be. She's, for good or bad, predictable essentially, but so would— every other candidate the Republican Party's ever put up until Donald Trump. You just don't know how he's going to react even when you call him on the carpet. And I think now some news and media outlets are nervous about that.
Richard Poole.
Yeah, I think there's a natural tendency of the press to try to treat the candidates as equivalent. But if you look at Hillary Clinton's actions and Donald Trump's with respect to the foundations, they're really very different. The Clinton Foundation was responsible really for curbing, in part, for curbing the worldwide AIDS epidemic. And they played an important role in that. The Clintons have not, for the most part, benefited from the foundation, certainly not directly. Donald Trump uses his foundation to further his own personal interests. And there's some question whether he used foundation money to bribe a Florida prosecutor that was getting set to investigate him. So to say those are equivalent really ignores the facts.
And how do you, as a Republican Party representative, Michael Franklin, grapple with there is definitely the core of the Republican Party, some people might call them establishment Republicans, who have publicly disavowed Donald Trump. They've said he is not someone who should be in the White House. That's a dangerous notion. He's a prevaricator. He's been called a pathological liar by people in his own party. So how do you negotiate that kind of a chasm within the party?
I think you'll always have that, and especially during campaign season. This aren't people – we don't know what they'll say once he's president or if he becomes president, but it's campaign season. Barack Obama did the exact same thing when he was running against Hillary Clinton, constantly saying she's unfit. It's campaigning. It's let's sling some mud and hopefully they don't remember if I get the party nomination. And with today's technological advances – and much more information-aware society, you can't say something and it be forgotten. It is always going to come back and get you. A lot of those comments were said at the very beginning of the primary.
Aaron King, give us some historical context here. Has there ever been a time when we've seen the two major political parties sort of hold their noses as they carry forward with presidential campaigns?
Well, I think this particular election is very interesting in the fact that Donald Trump is just not the usual sort of political candidate. I mean, both candidates have unfavorable ratings that are much higher than they've been in the past. And so a lot of times campaigns increase how much we like the candidates because we learn more about them. In this situation, we certainly know who Hillary Clinton is. We certainly know who Donald Trump is. There's not a lot of people that don't already have an opinion.
Can you think of another presidential campaign in which a former president, in this case, I think it was George Bush Sr., actually said, I have to vote for the other party because this candidate is so distasteful and unrealistic?
I mean, there's been some more extreme candidates in the past, I mean, like a George Wallace or a Barry Goldwater might come to mind. And it is notable now that you do see a lot of the political elites, especially former presidents, sort of lining up and in some cases going against what they would traditionally do. So I think that is different this year.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at partisan politics with the two local party leaders and Aaron King, who is an assistant professor of political science at UNCW. Carolyn writes, I think this election is the worst in my lifetime, almost 60 years, because the filters that people normally use in polite company have been turned off as being politically correct. I don't know how politeness and consideration for others' feelings became politically correct. If our children called neighbors people they didn't know or didn't like names that have been used by a presidential candidate, they would be corrected. Now you can call anyone anything and people clap. If we want to make America great again, let's have a return to manners. Use your vocabulary. Michael Franklin, I'll let you take that one.
I 100% agree with Carolyn. I think it's gotten a little out of hand. It's not so civil anymore. It's mudslinging across the aisle and on your same side of the aisle. And I would like to see it get a lot more professional and actually debate the issues instead of debating the way somebody looks or how they dress or things along that line. Absolutely.
And when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you both how we can do that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a closer look at the political divide. With us to answer your questions, both local party leaders, Richard Poole of the New Hanover County Democratic Party, Michael Franklin of the Republican Party, and UNCW political scientist Aaron King. When we come back from the break, we're taking your questions. Either email them to coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. As this election year shrinks and November 8th looms, the day Americans will choose a new president, North Carolinians will decide on legislators, and county residents will select people to represent them on commissions and school boards. We're taking a closer look at partisan strategies, party politics, and the chairman of New Hanover County's major political parties are here. Michael Franklin leads the Republican Party, Richard Poole, the Democratic Party, and UNCW political scientist Aaron King is here to provide academic and historical context. We're taking your questions and comments. What do you think about this unorthodox political season? Call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Michael Franklin, I promised right before we went to break that when we came back, I was going to ask you how we do bring politeness back to this and stop couching rudeness, downright rudeness, as political correctness. How do you think we need to do that?
I think it starts everywhere. I think it starts with the voters not accepting it from the candidates. You can't say, I like it from Hillary, but I hate it from Trump, and vice versa. You can't say, well, Trump is great when he does it, but Hillary's horrible when she does. And I think it's within the party leadership, especially here locally for us, Richard and I would never stand for a local candidate under my party to act like that. And I think the national level has to do the exact same thing. And as soon as you start holding people truly accountable for their actions and their comments, I think you start to see a swing. But it also has to change in society, too. If people are going to constantly allow the mudslinging, it's going to continue.
Richard Poole of the Democratic Party, you say the tone of this campaign is not necessarily new. When have we seen this kind of a political divide, this sort of nasty rhetoric before?
Well, in the history of our country, there have been many, many campaigns that were, involved mudslinging and insults. And I've been reading a book by John Dickerson called Whistle Stop that provides sort of anecdotal history of prior campaigns. And he compares Donald Trump to Andrew Jackson, who was a demagogue and committed genocide and was in many respects not an admirable person, but we survived his presidency.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about partisan politics, the political divide, especially how it will play out in North Carolina and in the Cape Fear region. With us today, Michael Franklin, chairman of the New Hanover County Republican Party, and Richard Poole, chairman of the New Hanover County Democratic Party, and political scientist Aaron King at UNCW. We have Sam from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Sam. I just want to bring it down to the state level a little bit. When Governor Pat McCrory has been in the news this past week and talking about a Shark City Council, and it's been going back and forth there about they're blaming each other about this mess that we're in, and it's costing the state a lot of money when it comes to collegiate sports and professional sports and losing business. And that way, I was just wondering about the take on that and where you see this is going.
Obviously, Sam is talking. Thank you so much for your question, Sam. Talking about HB2, Governor Pat McCrory recently called on Charlotte City Council to repeal their ordinance and said if the city of Charlotte repeals this ordinance that's popularly become known as the bathroom bill, then the state legislature will take a look at repealing HB2. What is happening there, Michael Franklin?
I think it's seen as a political statement or something that some people could hold on to, because McCrory's done a great job with the economy. He's done a great job with teachers compared to the last several governors we've had. So the state is moving in a better direction, and I think some people have grabbed hold of that, and everybody wants to focus on the bathroom portion. That's not everything HB2 has, but that's the piece that's gotten all the news press.
But you can't deny the fact that the state has seen just an exodus of money.
I can, but I question the timing of it.
What do you mean?
When that was signed over the summer, NCAA and ACC could have immediately pulled their support. They knew it wasn't going to change, or you could have threatened to pull it. Not a single one of them commented on it until we get closer to the election, and both McCrory and Cooper are tied. I question that. Maybe that has nothing to do with it. But to me, it's a little bit suspicious.
Richard Poole, what's going to happen with HB2? Where do we need to see this go as a state? How do we stop the bleeding?
I think Governor McCrory is looking for an escape route. It's clear to Republicans that it was a mistake. In practical terms, if not in broader terms, not in moral terms. It seems clear that he would like to step away from HB2 without annoying his base, the folks that favored it. And I don't know if he's going to be able to do that, honestly. But I noted that when the county commission candidates were here on Coastline, I believe it was just last week, two out of the three wanted to distance themselves from HB2.
That's right. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at partisan politics. Have we sunk to a historic low, or is this just part of the every 4 years playbook? Today, we're talking with Aaron King, an assistant professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, Richard Poole, chairman of New Hanover County's Democratic Party, and Michael Franklin, chairman of New Hanover County's Republican Party. And we're taking your questions and comments. What do you think about how the campaigns are being run this year? Are you happy with your choices? And what are we not talking about in this election season that we should be talking about? The phone lines are open at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. There is a new poll from Public Policy Polling, which is a left-leaning polling organization. However, Richard Poole, as you've pointed out, they do tend to be fairly accurate. They have said the presidential race in North Carolina is about as tight as it can be. And this poll just came out this morning, less than an hour ago. It's also becoming increasingly clear who will end up deciding the winner in the state. Voters who would like to continue the direction of President Obama's leadership, but who also strongly dislike Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump leads in the race in this state, in North Carolina, with 45% to 43% for Hillary Clinton, 6% for Gary Johnson. But when Johnson voters and undecideds are asked who they would pick if they had to choose between Clinton and Trump, the contest moves into a tie at 47%. Aaron King, What are the how are we to interpret this poll, and how accurate are some of these polls?
Well, of course, it's difficult to say how accurate each specific poll is as it came out just today. At the same time, I caution anyone to read too much into a single poll. Every polling firm is a little bit different. Every poll has to think about, well, who are the likely voters that we're looking at? How do we make this sample that we have as representative as possible? I just read an article in the New York Times yesterday about four different polling firms that were given the identical data from the state of Florida. And based off how they answered those two questions, all four of them came to a different conclusion about what their prediction might be for the election. So I always encourage anyone to look at the aggregation of polls. Websites like Real Clear Politics or 538, where they will take into things like sample size, response rates, people that are answering on cell phones, for example, and also to look at the track record of polls overall.
So talk to us about the voting sectors in North Carolina. Why is North Carolina such a critical swing state? Why is it so important in the presidential campaign? And what kind of divide are we seeing played out here?
Well, I think North Carolina is certainly one of the major battleground states. Of course, it's not alone. I think part of that has to do with the diversity of political opinions in the state, the diversity along a number of different dimensions, where unlike some areas of the country where it's primarily Republican, primarily Democrat, North Carolina is a really interesting mix of people, whether those be locals, urban, rural, academic, lower education, or people that are moving into the state as well. So it's a very diverse state, and with that comes diverse topics of conversation.
Trump was just here yesterday in the state and campaigned in Keenansville, population, I think, 850, as the Associated Press reported it.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, not Raleigh or Charlotte. Why, Michael Franklin, why Keenansville?
I think he's been here. He's been to the much more urban areas. He's been to Charlotte. He's been to Raleigh, Greensboro. I think he's just trying to spread his message, and that's another spot. And there's a place big enough to hold a 5,000 to 6,000 people spot there. So he wouldn't go, I don't think, to Wallace. They don't have something, but Keenansville definitely has the Civic Center. And I don't know if maybe it's responses from people locally asking Trump to come. It's campaigns make that decision, and I know they'll be all over the state. So
Aaron King, is it just a matter of time then before this influx that you've talked about that is part of the blue movement here in the state, I guess, to use a technical term, is that going to increase as time goes on, or is this, as Richard Poole has said, a battle for the soul of North Carolina that will be decided in this presidential election?
Well, I think every election people will say things like that. And at the same time, we have to recognize that, and these gentlemen here know this too, that political parties have greatly evolved over time. We see as demographics change, we see the political parties adjust and try to change their strategies accordingly. And so I do think that whether it's this election or the next one after this, both parties have to be introspective and think, how can we appeal to a broad segment of the population? And that's something that even in this, through the primaries, both parties have struggled with sort of keeping their core supporters together.
So what are the consequences of the kind of polarization that we're seeing? If people don't eventually come together, if the parties don't find ways of appealing to broader bases, where will we end up?
Well, I think you'll see a lot more of what people are worried about today, whether it be the inability to sit down and talk about things. It's more difficult for people to compromise. I believe you had said that so many people see compromise. Everyone wants to compromise. But of course, our definitions of what that is vary based off what we want to see happen. The Democrats want the Republicans to compromise. And the Republicans say, well, if I compromise, then I'm giving up my core principles. And then, of course, the Democrats will say the same thing on the other side. And so I think that both sides need to recognize the fact that you'll never get the other side to completely agree. And once we come to terms with that, then it becomes a little bit easier to have a civil dialogue.
Richard Poole, who do you think does a better job of compromising?
Well, if you look at our presidential candidates, it's pretty clear that Hillary Clinton over time has proved that she has the interest and ability to work across the aisle. And I don't see any evidence whatsoever that Donald Trump would
Michael Franklin?
I guess time will tell. So let's put him in the office and find out if he can compromise. And I get it. Hillary's been in the public eye and has been in politics for 40 years now. So, and that's just the nature of the candidate we have. We don't know what is – we know the team he's put together and what he says. But candidates always say a various thing, and then when they get in the office, they decide to change their mind or it can't be done. So it's going to be interesting to see who goes into the White House, the State House, and Congress, and see if they can all work together no matter which side it is.
Aaron King, can you pinpoint that moment in history when things started to polarize this way? People talk about the Reagan era when there was a great deal of compromise and things got done and government seemed to work. Is that true? Is that looking at government through rose-colored glasses and, you know, through the lens of history? When did this deep divide, this vitriol, really start to happen?
Well, I think, again, it is important to look at history. I think when we're living in the thrill of a certain campaign, it's tough to look back and reflect on things. And we've sort of seen this ebb and flow over time. I'd point out that in the 1800s, there was quite a bit of conflict in election, and there was a civil war. So we're at least not at that stage. At the same time, at the end of the 1800s, things were very polarized on sort of economic issues and with the progressive movement. At the same time, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, during that time, there were issues of race and social issues. And so I do think that, you know, you can say the social issues, maybe some foreign policy, Ronald Reagan. I think that the 60s were a turbulent time, and that has resulted in a lot of change, particularly around the South. But there's not just one way to pinpoint that, but a accumulation of things.
There is a majority in New Hanover County of unaffiliated voters, and I know the two of you, Richard Poole and Michael Franklin, are keenly aware of this. Richard Poole, how is the Democratic Party addressing this? What are your strategies for capturing those unaffiliated voters? Who do you think they are?
Well, there's the way I conceptualize it is, broadly speaking, there are three types of unaffiliated voters. There are the type that choose not to affiliate and they lean Republican. There are the ones who choose not to affiliate and they lean Democratic. And then there are the folks in the middle who are truly undecided. And it's a subset of that 50,000 some people that don't have a party affiliation. And I think we try to reach those people with messages from our candidates. We encourage them to listen to the candidates on both sides and think about their answers. That can be kind of challenging for anybody, and not all of the unaffiliated voters are necessarily well informed. So it is a challenge.
Michael Franklin.
I think you hit the nail on the head. There are the three aspects, but then there's also the bulk of voters are uninformed. Whether it's uninformed, they don't want to go search the messages of the candidates, or they don't know where to go, or they look at the wrong thing. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's The Onion, which is all misleading news stories. So if you do get caught up in that, I mean, that's a bit extreme, but it's definitely getting the information out of your candidates, whether it's
social media. Yeah, hopefully nobody thinks The Onion is an actual news source.
Let's hope so, but I have seen some people say, have you seen?
Okay.
So I'm like, oh, man. But it's definitely getting the information out. And I think with social media and the information age as it is now, it's much easier for candidates, but then it's also much easier to disseminate the wrong message on a candidate too. So it's definitely people being, I guess, cautious with the information they read and take it in from multiple sources and digest it and then form their opinion.
And you actually raise a really important point about the role that the media plays in all of this and how that role is changing. And we'll get to that in a second. But first, let's talk to Alan from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What I really wanted to say was that, simply put, we're not talking about third-party candidates. Your guests were speaking of compromise earlier. There doesn't have to be compromise. There can be fresh ideas laid forth on the table that are completely different from the two-party echo chamber we've been stuck in for hundreds of years.
Is there a specific policy idea that you have, Alan, that causes you to say that? What are you talking about?
I'm talking all across the board. We've been stuck in a two-party this or that system, and we really need to start pitching forth fresh ideas, fresh candidates, and not, you know, the same money, the same echoed voices. We need to broaden our horizons as a country, as a community, as people. The world isn't black and white. The world is big and colorful. The more options we have, the more free we are.
And that's an interesting point. Thank you so much for your call, Alan. Aaron King, there are other countries that have a different kind of system where multiple parties are represented. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I mean, Alan certainly echoes something that many people have talked about, and it's a concern that is often brought up, particularly when people don't like either side. At the same time, there are institutional reasons and the rules of what govern our country through the Constitution that help explain why we have a two-party system. The political scientists will talk about Duverger's Law. The idea being that in our country where we have a winner-take-all system, single-member districts, it favors the two-party system, as opposed to some other countries like you mentioned that have proportional representation.
And can you talk about how that works?
Sure, sure. So proportional representation, rather than voting for individual candidates, you would vote for a slate of candidates that are associated with one party or the other. And in those circumstances, say that there are 10 seats in the legislature. Well, if one political party gets 60% of the vote, they get 60% of the seats in the legislature. In the United States, under our rules, if you lose by one vote, you lose. It's a winner-take-all system. And so as much as there's a call for that to happen, we have to think about, well, what would it take? At the same time, we've seen a good amount of success in North Carolina, even with the third-party movement. So this is not to say that they couldn't have an impact. But as far as our system goes, two parties.
You're listening to an examination of the political divide in America, North Carolina, and the Cape Fear region. After this 90-second break, we'll return for the final segment. It's your last chance to ask a question or make a comment. Call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the divisions that characterize our political process and more our culture. With us to answer your questions, UNCW Assistant Professor of Political Science Aaron King, New Hanover County Democratic Party Chair Richard Poole, and New Hanover County Republican Party Chair Michael Franklin. And it's your last chance to tell us what's on your mind when it comes to this election. If you have a question or an observation, the number to call is 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Aaron King, right before we went to break, you were talking about multi-party systems and the third party progress in North Carolina. And you didn't really get a chance to speak to that. Can you finish your thought on how a third party is doing here?
Well, I think more so nationally, third parties struggle with things like getting on the ballot, for example, or getting onto the debate stage. And that was a lot of talk even with the presidential race. And again, like I talked about, our system as it's set up is not very conducive to that. One, because of the idea that people don't want to waste their vote. So you might really like Gary Johnson, but you say, well, if I vote for Gary Johnson, that's actually taking a vote away from the next person that has the best chance of winning. And so I think it's something that people do want to have other options. At the same time, maybe it's driven by the media, maybe it's driven by the rhetoric of political pundits. But there is a lot of diversity within each of the two political parties. These are not the ideological parties of places in Europe. And I think both these gentlemen can speak to that as well. There's not one type of person that's in each political party. So I think that's something that voters, if you sit down and think about how diverse the Republican Party is, whether it's the Tea Party conservatives or it's the more establishment people, or even in the presidential primary with the Democrats and the progressives under Bernie Sanders, there were multiple choices there, even if by the time Election Day rolls around, you have the two major parties.
Richard Poole, Michael Franklin, do you think we've become too big for a two-party system?
No.
Richard Poole, we'll start with you.
No, I don't think we're too big for a two-party system. However, I do think having third parties benefits our debate, and I welcome that. But are we too big for a two-party system. You know, the two-party system provides stability and continuity to our government that parliamentary form of government lacks. And I think very few people in the United States would trade our form of government for what Italy has.
Michael Franklin.
100% agree on that. I do not want Italy's government here. To echo what Richard said, I think we're not too big. If you want to see change, and I understand the concept of third parties, but there's two established parties with mechanisms in place to support their views. And for the most part, they are changing and they are open. So you can do it from within an established party. It's going to take you time, but it's going to take you time as a third party candidate too to establish yourself to the level of the Republicans and the Democrats party.
So what do you say then, Aaron King, to the people who would have voted for Bernie Sanders but who turn up their nose at Hillary Clinton, or those people who voted for John Kasich or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio but can't stand Donald Trump? And there are a lot of those people in the Republican Party, but they know if they vote for the third party candidate, it's just tossing away their vote.
Well, I think that's something right now that even in the polls, it's a little bit tough to know what to make of the third party support, because I think there are quite a few people that still are offering that sort of protest vote. At the same time, I tell my students that just because you vote for Trump or just because you vote for Clinton, that doesn't mean that you agree with everything that they say. Again, you have a choice presented on the ballot, and maybe it's choosing the lesser of two evils. Maybe it's choosing someone that you really value. At the same time, I think that people have to think carefully about which political party, which candidate gives them the best shot of advancing the agenda that they want. Just because you don't like one of the candidates doesn't mean a vote says that you're going to have to wear some button around all the time that says, hey, I'm a Trump supporter, I'm a Clinton supporter.
So it's not just the policymakers that need to learn to practice compromise and negotiation. It's
sure.
The voters as well. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at partisan politics. Today, we're talking with Aaron King, who's an assistant professor of political science at UNCW, Richard Poole, chairman of the New Hanover County Democratic Party, and Michael Franklin, chairman of the New Hanover County Republican Party. We're taking your questions and comments. What do you think about how the campaigns are run this year? Are you happy with your choices? And what are we not talking about that we should be? Phone lines are open, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Bob from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Since we're talking about partisan politics, I'd like to hear the Republican chairman's response to the fact that you can't get lower or more partisan than trying to take away people's right to vote. And even in the face of the federal judge saying that the North Carolina law did that, the Republican Party still continued to try to limit polling places and polling times. It's just outrageous. And this all started when the Republicans went after Barack Obama, and they continued to do that. I mean, the birther, it's just sad. It's really sad.
Well, let's let Michael, thank you so much for your call, Bob. Michael Franklin, let you respond to Bob.
I don't think, and I can speak for myself and those that I deal with in the party, nobody's trying to limit voting and who's available. It's trying to make sure every vote counts. That was the big push of voter ID law. It was not to exclude minorities. It was to exclude people that do not have a right to vote, that should not be here, that are here illegally, that are casting a vote under somebody else's name, or registering to vote last minute, and there's not time to vet that vote.
Although the court ruling was that African-American voters were gone after with surgical precision. I mean, that was the ruling.
I understand that was the ruling. I didn't write the law. I never read it as that. So if there was some backroom dealing for that, that may have been possible, especially locally here when we were pushing back against it. That was never in our discussion as to let's limit one sector of legal voters, people that have a legal right to vote. That was never in our in our decision-making process, just trying to eliminate that?
You know, it's an interesting question because there's the voting law, and then there's setting up the hours for voting, the days that, you know, people are able to register and vote. And Richard Poole, I know you have an opinion on this, and I'll get to you in 1 second. Dallas Woodhouse, the Republican State Party executive director, was recently called out for encouraging local election boards to favor Republican voting patterns. And he essentially said, hey, I'm the executive director for Republican Party. Of course I want to help my party. And wouldn't anyone, Richard Poole, isn't that your job to help, in your case, the Democratic voters, which also tend to be African Americans?
I like to see people vote. I think that's good. And it is a difference between the party that Democrats want to see more people vote and make it easier to vote, and Republicans prefer low turnout elections and prefer to have less people voting. It's just a fact. Dallas Woodhouse also called on local county boards of elections to cut back on early voting along purely partisan lines. Here locally, we ended up with an early voting plan by the Republican-dominated Board of Elections that really only had voting during banker's hours from 9 to 5 for people that work, for people that have children, for people that have care responsibilities, for people in their family. Those daytime banker's hours are very difficult. We advocated more evening hours and more weekend hours. And in fact, when it went up to the State Board of Elections, there were evening hours added on only 2 days. But we've got a voting plan that that really is going to make it more difficult for people to vote. And it's also going to have effects in this election because of other changes. Here locally in 2012, 50% of voters voted straight ticket ballot. And you can argue one way or the other about whether voting straight ticket is smart or, you know, constructive. But it's a fact that you can vote straight ticket more quickly than if you have to go through and pick out each and every candidate. And we estimate that if it takes 1 minute longer to vote on individual candidates rather than to vote a straight ticket ballot, that's going to add 800 hours of delay into our early voting. If it takes 2 minutes longer, 1,600 hours. And the way that'll be expressed is in those final days of early voting when there are already going to be lines. Those lines are going to be much longer.
Michael Franklin, your response.
I just wanted to point out that the plan that was put forth by the Board of Elections, and yes, we have the governor's seat, so it is a partisan board. It always has been, always will be. That plan that was put forward and voted on by two Republicans and voted down by the Democrat member is the exact same plan that Democrats that ran that board in 2012 put forward. We didn't reduce it from the original plan that when you had power for that, you put the plan forward. We said it. We said, all right, we'll take it. That's fair. You guys came up with it originally, and we're good. And yes, the state added extra hours. That's fine. But let's also think back. I don't know. I think there's 26 states that have no early voting. You vote on election day. That's been the history of this country. I think some people, you get a little piece and you always want more. You're never happy with the extra little piece you get.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about partisan politics, political strategies. Is this just part of the every 4 years playbook, or have we reached a new low? Today we have Richard Poole, chair of New Hanover County's Democratic Party, Michael Franklin, chair of New Hanover County's Republican Party, and Aaron King, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And we have Nicole from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Nicole. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
I have to say I'm incredibly resentful and disturbed by a comment you made about 10 minutes ago when you referred to third-party voting as wasting your vote. That has been an overwhelming theme for individuals who choose to vote for a third party, who choose to either vote for the Green Party or the Libertarian Party. And it's just become this mantra of Republicans and Democrats both saying, well, if you do that, you're just wasting your vote. A vote for your conscience is never wasting your vote. And there are three presidential candidates on the ticket in all 50 states. So this year, you don't have to choose the lesser of two evils. You can choose something different.
Nicole, you make an excellent point. What do you say then when a minority of people will do that? We know a minority of people will vote third party. And so that is not the candidate. And this is the rub. This is exactly the struggle that I think a lot of people who supported other candidates who did not become the nominee undergo when they're looking at the third party versus those two major political parties.
And I completely agree with you. That is the rub. And as long as the primary political parties continue to browbeat people into believing, well, you know, a vote for Gary Johnson is a vote for Donald Trump, or, you know, a vote for Jill Stein is just a vote for Hillary. It's not. It's your vote. Mm-hmm. Each of us has the right to vote our own conscience. And the reality is that in this particular election, I have always voted Democrat. Always. I will not vote Democrat in this election.
Nicole, thank you. Yes, yeah, and you've made your point. I want to get Aaron King, political scientist, to respond to that. Thank you so much for your call. Go ahead, Aaron King.
Well, sure. From the perspective of a third-party voter, I think the wasted vote idea is in the sense mathematically. And to be fair, there is, for all the listeners, your individual vote mathematically will not determine the end result of this election, whether you vote for Trump, whether you vote for Clinton, whether you vote for Johnson. At the same time, I do certainly respect the idea. Many people do see their right to vote as their civic duty and sort of voting their conscience.
Absolutely.
So I want to make sure to make that clear. And this does represent one of the struggles that third parties have, because whether or not factually these things, people have the perception that, geez, you know, I want to end up picking the winner. I want to back the winning horse. And so it's a very difficult road for third parties to go on.
And we don't have time to take this last caller, but Eric from Jacksonville notes it's interesting that independents have to work their way into the two-party system as Sanders and Trump did. Yet Trump was allowed to go through, Sanders was not allowed. Michael Franklin, when you look at the Republican base, the party faithful, the core, how would you explain to your great-grandchildren how Trump became the nominee in 2016?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I think it has to do with, like Dr. said over here, you have to vote your conscience, and that's where a lot of people in the Republican Party were voting. They were tired of the same old, and they didn't like the rhetoric, and they saw something new. They saw something that challenged the system that we currently have in the Republican Party. Whether it works for us, we'll find out in a few days, 48 days, I believe. But it's just that you don't know unless you try, and you have – that's what your vote's for.
And what role is the media playing in either shining a light on the truths that people aren't looking at, for instance, calling out candidates when they do a dance with the truth or get a little hyperbolic in their campaign rhetoric, versus furthering the divides in this culture war? Is the media doing a good job, Richard Poole? What is the media missing?
Sometimes I think the media tends to draw equivalences between candidates when there is none. Sometimes I think the media fails to follow up and dig out information. But on the other hand, they have a hard job to do, and it's difficult to always do it well. So, you know, I see both sides of that.
That's this edition of Coastline. Aaron King, Richard Poole, Michael Franklin, thank you all for joining us today. Remember, one-stop voting begins October 20th. October 14th is the deadline to register to vote in the November 8th election. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Thank you.